Hello, Crime Salad listeners. We are thrilled to have you with us. I am Ashley.
And I'm Ricky.
And this week, we are diving into a chilling narrative that unfolded in the 1990s and occurred in Phoenix, Arizona, and even in Everett, Washington. Attacks that were possibly done by the same man. Our story revolves around a man who walked around in a trench coat and a mask and drove in a retired police car with the eerie alias the Zombie Hunter. And two haunting murder cases that lingered in the shadows, unsolved for years. It wasn't until recently, when DNA testing techniques advanced, and the pieces of this puzzle began to fall into place. A suspect who has been on the radar of the investigation for decades was finally linked to the crimes through a perfect DNA match, turning the page on a mystery that had long awaited closure. I mean, it's an incredible feeling. Like every time I see a headline stating that there's this cold case that has been solved, I get like this little butterfly feeling.
You know why?
Why?
You are a crime nerd, my friend. Such a freaking nerd.
And you're married to me.
No, but really, the fact that they even kept all of this DNA evidence like in storage so that once technology caught up to the point that we could actually solve these cases, like we could have just been like, yep, nothing we could have done here, but we kept it.
Yeah. Like, oh, here's some guy's semen. I'll throw that out. We don't need it.
Yeah. Just scrape it off the table and throw it in the trash.
Now, this Crime Salad episode comes with a content warning. There will be mentions of the young women whose lives were tragically lost at the hands of a killer who preyed on his victims and attacked them with a knife for his own selfish fulfillment. Disturbing is an understatement, so please take the warning seriously because it mentions kidnapping, sexual assault, mutilation, and the complete heartbreak and devastation that the victims' families faced.
Yeah, F this dude.
So, if you're still here, let's start from the beginning as we unravel the details of these attacks and the breakthrough that brought long overdue justice.
I think we should give a moment of silence for anyone who doesn't want to move forward to drop off.
See ya.
Bye. All right, for now, you sickos. No, I'm just kidding.
So in November of 1992, a bicyclist was riding along the cemented path that runs alongside the Phoenix, Arizona Canal, a popular spot where bikers, walkers, and joggers are active. It was after the hot Arizona sun cooled down when they discovered what appeared to be a thick, bloody substance on the cemented bike path that looked like drag marks. And then there was a body floating in the Arizona Canal. After contacting the police, a naked female body was recovered from the canal. The body was covered in stab wounds and was decapitated.
Yeah.
The missing head was discovered 11 days later, identifying the person as 21-year-old Angela Brasso. Now, the police reported that it was in very good condition. It was believed to have been kept on ice and treated as a trophy before being dumped into the water and soon discovered 11 days later. If it were in the water for 11 days, the effects from being in the water for that long, the wildlife, the decomposition, it would have without a doubt altered the appearance. But the records stated it was in good condition.
That's gross.
And the autopsy revealed that the young woman had been sexually assaulted. So it was a frightening discovery that shocked the family and terrified the community. Even being outside, especially alone at night, was concerning for everyone. The fear and the panic of knowing someone was out there and capable of such a horrific attack terrified everyone. And as we said, this case wasn't solved for about 20 years.
It's a long time.
It's a scary thought, though, isn't it? Like the idea that a murderer could just be anyone around us. It could be the guy at the gas station filling up his car or someone picking out groceries at a grocery store. or even someone dressed up like a zombie hunter waving at people who recognize him on the street, taking pictures with him.
But that one, that one seems a little more obvious.
But no one suspected him of being a killer. All right, so have you ever tried to break a bad habit and felt like you're paddling upstream with a spoon? Yeah, we've been there too. But here's a breath of fresh air. Fume. It's not about giving up. It's about switching up. Fume takes your habit and simply makes it healthier and more enjoyable. Fume is an innovative, award-winning flavored air device that does just that. Instead of vapor, Fume uses flavored air. Instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavors. So you get it. Instead of bad, Fume is good. It's a habit you're free to enjoy and makes replacing your bad habit easy. Your Fume comes with an adjustable airflow dial and is designed with movable parts and magnets for fidgeting, giving your fingers a lot to do, which is helpful for de-stressing and anxiety while breaking your habit. Honestly, I didn't know what to expect about the taste, but wow, the Fume flavors taste like you're biting into something super fresh. If we're comparing, it's like choosing a chill herbal tea over a sticky sweet soda. Fume's got those natural, not too sweet vibes. It's refreshing in a just brewed cup of herbal goodness kind of way. And it's got the perfect balance and weight to it that makes it super satisfying to hold. Kind of like the best fidget spinner you never knew you needed. With its real wood, sleek shape, it's kind of a statement piece, which makes you feel a bit more fancy and cool using it. Plus, Fume just released a magnetic stand for your Fume, so there's no more losing it in the couch or around the house. It's built in with fidgeting in mind. You can spin your Fume around on it. Start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/salad and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of the show 10% off when they use our code SALAD to help make starting the good habit that much easier. Then about a year later, another body was discovered at the bottom of the Arizona Canal in September of 1993 and was later identified as Melanie Bernas. She was found less than a mile from where Angela was believed to have been attacked. Melanie's body was mangled and carved, and the medical examiner discovered evidence of sexual assault. This young girl, who fell victim to such evil, shared a hauntingly similar story to Angela Brasso. They were both out bicycling along the city's canal, enjoying some alone time, embracing the setting Arizona sun and the warm air before the day was over. Who doesn't love the feeling of freedom that comes with a good bike ride? Gliding along with the wind in your hair. Now, as long as we're not biking uphill, it can be incredibly soothing. It makes me angry thinking that what Angela and Melanie were doing, just simply experiencing a beautiful Arizona evening, why do we have to worry about this shadow of fear looming over a simple human experience? The thought that we have to hold back from fully embracing life's simple pleasures because of the fear of someone attacking you, frankly, is just so frustrating. And so in Angela's situation, and also in Melanie's situation, they were out enjoying a bike ride along the canal, living in the moment. But what either of them didn't know is that there's someone hiding nearby, watching them like a predator, waiting in the shadows, ready to jump out like there's some kind of prey, waiting for the perfect chance to make a move, carrying around a dark wish for way too long. And it was at these two separate moments that he played out his sick desires. Adding to the mystery, the bicycles of both the women vanished without a trace. Yet the DNA evidence found with them was kept, even though there wasn't much to do with that evidence at the time. It pointed to a single predator, although it wasn't until recently that the advanced DNA testing techniques managed to confirm Brian Patrick Miller as the man responsible. For years, the family of Angela Brasso and Melanie Bernas we're left in agonizing uncertainty, clinging to the hope for justice for their daughters. As time ticked on, the hope must have felt increasingly distant, perhaps even impossible. The victims, Angela, who was about to turn 22, and Melanie, a 17-year-old high school student, they were daughters, they were friends, and positive influences in the lives of those who knew them. They were living a life of endless possibilities. Their brutal murders not only left an indelible mark on their families, but it also shook the Phoenix community, unaware of when the next attack would happen. Once the family learned the details of these young women who were brutally attacked and murdered, a dark cloud hung over Angela Brasso and Melanie Bernice's family and friends, and their hunt for justice went on for years. This case became colder as leads ran out and hope for justice seemed to fade. The Phoenix Police Department determined not to let this case go unsolved, and so they came up with a list of potential suspects. And as DNA technology advanced, they were eventually led to Brian Patrick Miller, a divorced father working at an Amazon fulfillment center, who was better known as the zombie hunter in the area. A man who had seamlessly blended into society and evaded suspicion for over two decades. And yeah, like I said, the zombie hunter. Maybe this was a way of expressing himself. It would be something that you would most likely see around Halloween or at a comic convention. But this guy drove around in an old police car marked with fake blood smears and bloody handprints and had lettering stickers that spelled out the zombie hunter on the back of the car. And the back seat, there was a fake zombie looking like it just got apprehended. This eye-catching local character was a magnet for people, even cops, who couldn't resist coming over for a photo opportunity with the zombie hunter. To anyone passing by, he just seemed like a regular guy really into zombie hunting, but complete with a toy gun, a trench coat, and a mask. He just blended in, looking like any other fan hoping to give out a few smiles. Or was this a way for him to hide in plain sight? People would get excited when they would see the zombie hunter. They would wave at him, take pictures with him. It was like this fun thing that happened locally. It's so crazy that this guy was a murderer. It almost reminds you of John Wayne Gacy, who dressed up as a clown and got hired for children's parties. Someone who you would least expect. And maybe that's what he wanted you to think. Maybe this was a ruse to put on a mask and hide behind who he truly was. So like we mentioned, a list was made of potential suspects, and he made the list. Brian Miller was arrested in January of 2015 for the murders of Angela Brasso, who was murdered in November of 1992, and Melanie Bernice, who was murdered in September of 1993. The lengthy period between the crimes and his arrest is attributed to the limitations of investigative techniques at the time of the murders and the subsequent development of DNA analysis, which eventually led to his identification as a suspect. Now, there's a lot to unpack here, so buckle up. The Phoenix police believed that he killed a third person, 13-year-old Brandy Lynn Myers. She went missing on May 26, 1992, while going door-to-door, collecting money for a fundraiser in the same Phoenix neighborhood as Brian Miller. In fact, she lived just two doors down from his house. Her disappearance prompted a widespread search across the desert in the mountains. And during the search for Brandy, the day after her disappearance, an ATV rider noticed a pair of thick glasses while driving through the desert. Now, at first, the ATV rider assumed that it had to be Brandy, because her disappearance had been widely publicized and the community was well aware. The body was decomposing, leaving only skeletal remains, the outfit that she was wearing, and her glasses. Investigators assumed that this wasn't Brandy because the level of decomposition, and she was missing the previous day. Now, an autopsy revealed that the cause of death for this young girl who was found was strangulation. So as you might expect, the early 1990s in this area were fraught with fear that this killer was out killing these young women. It wasn't until 2011 that she was identified as Shannon Amok, a 16-year-old who went missing 8 weeks before. That's pretty rough. 2 decades later, so 20 years later, the young woman, a Jane Doe, was identified as Shannon Michelle Amok. One thing about her disappearance was the lack of information indicating that anyone was looking for her. In the spring of 1992, she allegedly ran away from her group home. She had been in the foster care system since age 3, and she was first adopted by a family, but was returned back to the system due to uncontrollable behavior. She had been transferred from different foster homes and group homes approximately 40 different times. And during her time in the foster care system, she was known to be a frequent runaway, never feeling stable, constantly moving in and out of the foster care system, and never feeling like she had a home. So when she went missing this last time from the group home, she was reported missing. But due to the number of times that she had run-ins with the law or fled, she was released from child services, and her missing report was never investigated. Which is unfortunate. They essentially gave up on her, even though she was 16, still underage. Now, Shannon looked like Brandy, and they both were about the same age. They met their death just a few miles from Brandy's home. The police believe that Brian was also responsible for Shannon's death. However, he was never charged, and her case has yet to be solved. Prosecutors did not proceed with the case because there was insufficient evidence. So, like we said, this case is still waiting to be solved. Now, Amy, Brian Miller's ex-wife, came forward and basically confirmed the suspicions. Brian Miller admitted in an interview that he despises his ex-wife, Amy. This is most likely due to her knowledge about what he does, the things that he's into. They were married for 9 years, and they had one daughter together. And during those 9 years, Amy experienced fear herself, but she was too afraid for her life to report it to the police, fearing that he would come after her if she did. Now, Amy explained a number of things about Brian that would make you nervous to be in the same room with him. One being the case of Brandy Lynn Myers, a 13-year-old girl who went missing, and he was the suspect. Despite the fact that he was never charged, her body was never found. Amy came forward to the police telling them that Brian confessed to her that when she knocked on the door, he pulled her inside, attacked her with a knife, and chopped her body up. It's believed that he kept Brandy Lynn Myers' remains in a bathtub over ice, but once the smell of decomposition became too strong, he disposed of her body in trash bags and left the trash bags out for the garbage men to pick up. He also kept a list of women that he thought were attractive, and she explained that he would put a star next to their names, which would indicate that he wanted to harm or kill them. Amy flipped through this green spiral handheld notepad that once belonged to Brian as she explained what she knew in court. This had to have been so frightening for Amy and was probably one of the many reasons why they ended up with a divorce. Amy also mentioned that he had told her of a stabbing incident that he was arrested for, and this was in his records. His records showed that he spent time in a juvenile detention center for a stabbing incident when he was younger. Celeste Bentley, 24, was riding the bus to work in May of 1989. She got off at her bus stop when a younger boy ran past her as she felt something hit her upper back. When she reached her hand to her back, she was confused at what happened, thinking that this random kid just punched her and ran away. There was blood. She realized she had been stabbed. Now, fortunately, she was able to make it safely inside the grocery store where she worked, and they called for help, And eventually, they were able to find and arrest the young boy, whom Celeste was able to identify. Doctors confirmed that if the blade had gone in a different direction, her lung could have been punctured, which could have been fatal. Now, this was Brian's first incident that we are aware of, who was 16 years old at the time and attending high school. Now, while he was in a juvenile detention center, his mother was going through his belongings and discovered a disturbing note that stated how he wanted to kidnap a girl, rape, murder, and dismember her, and do a number of disturbing other things. Essentially, his written out plan for what would eventually happen. On this same piece of paper, there was also a plan to decapitate someone while preserving their head. Now, Brian's mother was so disturbed by this note that she handed it over to the cops. And she was so disturbed that she didn't want him back in the house. She didn't want to live with him. So when he was released from the juvenile detention center at the age of 18, she was concerned for her safety, didn't want him around, so he stayed in a halfway house. So after this, he began to act out his dark fantasies. But he hid behind his alter ego, the zombie hunter. He married Amy, and they had a child together. They eventually divorced, and he got a place to live with his daughter. During his marriage, Amy mentioned that they had lived in Washington in the early 2000s, and during their stay in Washington, a few other bodies mysteriously appeared, and their cases have yet to be solved. And they were discovered in the same way the bodies in the canal were found. So who knows how many other people he killed? On May 23, 2002, while they were still living in Washington, a young woman named Melissa was walking through Everett, Washington. He pulled up next to her and offered her a ride. She recognized him from hanging out at a friend's apartment complex, and she took the offer. As they were driving, they discussed how some trails and some paths in the area were known to be dangerous, not realizing that the person inside the car who was driving her around was capable of murder. During this ride, Brian decided to bring her to his workplace because she needed to use a phone, but then he stabbed her in the back with a 12-inch serrated knife. Now, just to remind you, this is in 2002. After the 90s murders, after multiple attacks that he said that he was involved in, you would think that this is where, you know, the police would say, all right, game over, Brian. But no, he was arrested for the attack, but he got off the hook, claiming that Melissa was attempting to rob him. And just like that, he was free. It's unbelievable how he got off the hook. So when he went to court, the jury didn't believe what Melissa was saying. It was essentially a he said, she said situation where they didn't know who to believe. This married man with a daughter, a job, someone who drives a car compared to this woman who didn't have a car, who took this ride from this guy, who didn't have a phone, who seemed like she was hitchhiking. It painted this picture that he was innocent and she was the bad one when it was the other way around. Now, being the wife married to Brian Miller, Amy was always scared of him. But it was kind of like she was so scared to the point where, you know, if she said anything to the police or if she tried to leave, would he try to hurt her? Now, during his time in jail with this last incident, they would exchange letters back and forth. And at first, the letters were nice. He would be claiming his innocence, sounding sweet, you know, this husband that misses his wife. But eventually, these letters would take a dark sexual turn, like saying that when he gets out of jail, he'll do all these things to her. And when he got home, the things that he said he would do in these letters began to happen. For example, during sex, he sometimes would hold a knife to her throat, and sometimes he would use needles on her or tie her up, all without her permission. So as you might expect, that incident was just over the line. And the thought of the secret notebook he kept, the stabbing incidents that he mentioned, the murder that he mentioned, all these different stories were so frightening to Amy, and she's scared for her life. So eventually they get a divorce. She just gets out of this relationship. But Amy would agree that she never seen this side of him before, this evil, dark, sexual deviant side. This was different. As time passed and DNA evidence technology advanced, it became necessary to connect his actual DNA to DNA evidence preserved from the two bodies discovered in the 1990s. So, in January of 2015, a detective went undercover, knowing Brian was working at an Amazon fulfillment center in Phoenix, Arizona. He approached his car, possibly he was on his lunch break, hanging out in his car, and he stated that he's looking to hire someone for $20 an hour to work as a security guard because there has been several instances where someone is stealing items from the Amazon trucks. $20 an hour? Heck yeah. Now, this was all a part of a well-thought-out plan to obtain Brian's DNA. And they went to a local Chili's to discuss the job further. Brian also brought his teenage daughter with them, giving Brian Miller an air of innocence, as if he were this single father with his teenage daughter, you know, looking for a decent job. The detective was able to obtain his DNA from the cup that he was drinking water from, and his DNA was an exact match to the DNA found on the two victims decades ago in the early 1990s. Angela Brasso, 21, who had been stabbed repeatedly, sexually assaulted, decapitated, mutilated, and left in the water to be discovered. And Melanie Burness, 17, who had been subjected to the same vicious attack years ago. Now, we often hear that murderers like Brian Miller had a terrible childhood filled with rejection and trauma. Brian grew up without his father, so he was primarily raised by his mother, whom Brian claims tortured him. His mother ran a strict household and worked as a detention officer. He claims that there would be a lot of mental and physical abuse in the house beginning at the age of 5. This was used as evidence in his defense. In court, the defense admitted that he was the canal killer, but they argued that he was not guilty due to insanity. Brian claims that he has no memory of the killings of the two women. The defense explained this by claiming that his mother exposed him to violent sexual content at a young age. She taught him about her pornographic interests and allowed him to watch extremely violent films. People from Brian's past came forward and would agree that he had a troubled upbringing. A neighbor who lived close to Brian's childhood home shared that his mom would show this bitterness about Brian and how Brian should have died instead of her husband. Brian's father died in a motorcycle crash. It was also claimed that due to how he was treated, he did not develop many social skills or possess any skills. It was as if he was constantly reminded that he was not loved or welcomed or even supposed to be there. Although this does not justify committing murder, some believe that this was a recipe for Brian's evil behavior. All the blame was placed on his mother, who died in 2010. Although there was evidence that hinted he was abused, it wasn't enough to convince the judge, who had to make the decision of the amount of justice he should serve. This comes in the wake of a harrowing ordeal where the loved ones of two young women faced years of seeking for justice and the unspeakable violence, enduring assault, rape, stabbing, and mutilation, and with one of the victims tragically being decapitated. As the judge stated, the defendant did not simply murder them. He brutalized them. I believe she said it perfectly. These women had their entire lives ahead of them, and Brian hid in plain sight for 20 years, allowing him to avoid prison. He got to raise his daughter and live this normal life that those two girls never got to experience. Brian Patrick Miller was sentenced to death in June of 2023 for two horrific murders that shook Phoenix in the early 1990s. Now, while the wheels of justice have finally turned, bringing a semblance of safety back to the community after many long years, the agony endured by the family of these young women, the hurt taken from them in such a barbaric manner remains, and that feeling will never go away. What happened to them can't be changed. Our hearts go out to the family members and the friends of these two young women, and also anyone else who has been attacked by Brian or whose case has never been solved. We hope that they can find some kind of peace now that this monster has been sentenced. And that completes this week's episode. Thank you all so much for listening to Crime Salad. Make sure you subscribe wherever you are and leave us a 5-star review. By the way, thank you for the awesome reviews. They are so amazing. It's so weird because we see the numbers of the people who are listening, and that's really all we get. But when we get these reviews or like your comments or your messages, it's just real. And it's just so awesome to see. You guys just keep our show growing. Thank you all so much for listening and supporting our show. We really, really appreciate it. And we will be back next week.